The introduction. As Jean mentioned, this is a mining webinar series, and I would like to just make sure everyone is aware that we have lots of information about mining site treatment technologies for cleanup of sites at this website here. It's on Kluin, kluin.org/mining. We keep it up to date with events such as today's webinar, but also conferences and other meetings. News stories are in the spotlight here. On the main page, we have information on characterizing site and different cleanup technologies. So I just wanted to make everyone aware of this website where you can get more information related to what we're finding about cleanup of contaminated sites, particularly mining. And as we also mentioned, this is part of a mining webinar series. And our webinars are all archived, and we do have a link to all of these archives at the website that you see here. So if you want to go back and peruse what topics we've presented in the past and replay them at your leisure, this is where you can find them. And you'll also find that today's webinar, once it's available as an archive, will be posted on this webpage also. So today, Jean introduced the topic for today, but these are our two presenters that we're going to have today. We have Roger Hoogerheide, who is the Remedial Project Manager in EPA's Region 8 office. Roger has over 20 years working in a couple different EPA offices in D.C., Denver, and now he's in the Helena, Montana office, where he oversees remediation of 6 Superfund sites in Montana, 2 of which are lead and zinc mining districts in the Little Belt Mountains. And then we also have Eric Wieland from Freeport-McMoRan, who's an internationally respected geochemist with over 40 years of professional experience and technical knowledge spanning multiple disciplines. Eric has successfully worked on many projects across many countries using geochemical principles, methods, and interpretation, and he's going to present some of that today. So we'll get an overview of biologically based passive remediation technologies and its applicability to mining sites. And then we're also going to have 2 case studies that they're going to talk about, the Iron King mine near Jerome, Arizona, and the Garfield mine near Delta, Colorado. So with that, I would like to move us on to have some introductory remarks from Roger Hoogerheide.
Okay, and Roger, I'm going to make you come off of mute here in but a moment while your slides are loading. Roger, whenever you're with us on the lines, feel free to begin.
Okay, thanks. And thanks, Michelle. So I just have about 9 slides before I let it, before I give it to Eric. As Michelle said, I have 2 Superfund sites located in Montana in the Little Belt Mountains. And I have a different approach in that we're working for the federal government. We're constrained both on our ability to get sufficient resources and technical expertise. So I have done a good job of collaborating and partnershipping with landowners, the universities in the state of Montana, and what you'll see coming out in Eric's presentation is a collaboration with the mining industry to help with cleanup challenges at Superfund sites. Hold on here. There we go. All right, so my 2 mining districts, they're co-located next to each other, as Michelle said, in the Little Belt Mountains, about 55 miles south of Great Falls, and driving distance, because if you look as the crow flies, we're about the same distance, Helena to Great Falls. It's about 120 miles for me to drive from Helena to get these to these sites. Both sites have multiple patented mining claims, but they're located within the Lewis and Clark Helena National Forest System. These 2 mining districts were both discovered around 1879. This is when the state, well, Montana was a territory at the time. It wasn't even a state. And the first phase of mining, they worked the rich silver deposits near the surface. carted those silver deposits by oxen to Fort Benton, which was as far north as the steamboats could get on the Missouri River. At the time when the Montana was a territory, Fort Benton was the largest community in Montana. The first phase of mining in these districts lasted till about 1883, and it was hampered both by transportation costs as well as fluctuating silver prices. The second phase of mining began in the 1890s, and this was with the construction of the rail lines throughout the West, and there was also construction of two smelters, one in Great Falls and one in Helena. And as a result of that, the mining in these districts, they followed the rich veins underground. In addition to having a couple of large-scale mine operators, there were multiple small-scale miners during this time. And I do want to emphasize that in today's economy, in the developed world, this isn't possible, but if you're looking at mining from the perspective of the developing world, this is happening in a lot of places throughout the world. Mining discontinued in the second phase of mining around the turn of the century, and it was as a result of a drop in metal prices. This particular mine, this is the Queen of the Hills Galt Mine, located in the Carpenter Stowe Creek Mining District. I do have a couple of arrows that kind of point where there's mine portal openings, and then at the top there's a shaft, and then the dark areas are the ore bodies that they were actually mining. So this next slide to the left shows when we did an investigation in 2011, all of the yellow dots are actually soil samples that we took. We took five-point composite samples on quarter acres. Anything in red, if you know, is where those portal openings were, and you actually have water coming out. A little bit further below, Gene, I don't have my green arrow to show. There it is, thanks. You can see highway right here, and with regards to looking at what we plan to do at this particular mine, we could look at possibility of putting in some flow-through bulkheads, but really, if you saw the previous slide, all we're going to do is just chase that water uphill, and the proximity of the highway to this particular mine presents challenges in itself. And the flows coming out of most of these added discharges are in the range of probably 1 to 7 gallons per minute. So although Freeport-McMoRan is not responsible for this particular mine, I did want to highlight it because this is one that I think is a good candidate for implementation of passive bioremediation systems. So the third phase of mining in these districts occurred in the 1920s, and this was with the construction of the mills and also the large tailings impoundments. I have tailings impoundments at both. This particular slide, I do want to give a shout-out. We do have these mine EDU webinars that are not webinars, but courses that we can take online. This particular picture was taken in China, but when I look at it, I kind of see this is what the tailings impoundments in the United States probably looked like in the 1920s when they were placing. At the time, this was probably state-of-the-art engineering practices, but clearly that wouldn't pass today. So what I've found in my 7 years of working on both of these sites is it's all about the water. The slide to the left, the Silver Dyke mine, this particular mine has a flow of about 15 gallons per minute, base flow throughout the year. Zinc concentrations in this particular mine are around 150,000 parts per billion. We estimate about 30,000 pounds of zinc are discharging into the watershed just from this particular mine. The one on the bottom, Ripple, what I do want to point out is as you, the mine just keeps on going, you can kind of see the mine waste even going further down. There's one of my sampling partners. We were taking a five-point composite sample here. The Ripple mine, multiple layers, and at the very bottom of this particular mine, we have an added discharge coming out at about 70 gallons per minute. The slide on the next one, the lower Carpenter Creek tailings, this is a unsecured impoundment. We were actually lucky to be up there during a thunderstorm a couple of years ago, and you can just see how much erosion is taking place as a result of the unsecured tailings piles. The slide on the bottom, the Block P, this particular mine, we did a removal action on it from 2011 to 2013. We removed about 230,000 cubic yards of overburden and waste rock. What remains now is the mine-influenced water discharges. And I don't know if anybody's going to be going to the mining conference in Fairmont, Montana next week, but myself and Doe Run, who was the responsible party for doing the removal action here, we did some work on this particular mine in 2017 to do some source control, and we'll be given a presentation at the Fairmont Mining Conference next week. Regulatory involvement. So the state of Montana did an inventory of all mine sites in the state on these particular mining districts. They identified 50 priority sites, 40 discharging adits. Because there was exploration and some mining that occurred in the 1980s at both of these districts, the state could not use their abandoned mine lands funds to do any type of work. So that led to Superfund listing in 2001 at both sites. We're currently in the remedial investigation feasibility study phase. And as I kind of talked earlier about the Block P mine, we've addressed probably about 15% of the priority mines solid waste using interim actions such as removal actions to do it. What we have been doing in looking at the I'm going to go to the next slide to let everybody kind of read about a collaboration approach that Doe Run Resources came to EPA to work on the Barker Hughesville site where they have some liability. But we are in feasibility study phase at both sites, and we're looking at water treatment costs in the range of $50 million plus. And really, in order for us to meet ambient water quality standards, by default, we are looking at building a dedicated water treatment plant and bringing that water to a centralized location for treatment. I really had difficulties going forward to the public to present these remedies, and also just the sheer fact of trying to get that kind of funding when we're dealing more with ecological risk as opposed to human health, there would be challenges with that as well. And so I approached some of the mining companies that are at both of my sites and asked them to do some collaboration. And the Mount Evans Mining Company, which is a subsidiary of Freeport-McMoRan, so they did some exploration at both of these sites in the 1980s, and at the Carpenter Snow Creek site, they actually are a property owner. And what we did last year was we entered into administrative orders on consent to allow them to collect water at one mine in the Barker Hughesville Mining District and another mine in the Carpenter Snow Creek Mining District, where they're doing laboratory testing. And Eric will talk about the preliminary results of that testing in a little bit. The other thing that came out of this administrative order, and really the relationship building, because I do want to give a shout out to Barb Nielsen, who is the project manager for Freeport-McMoRan. We've been working together for multiple years. I feel we've built a relationship on trust, and I consider her a friend as well. And what we did was in February, so a couple of months ago, there was about eight people from EPA, from several regions, EPA headquarters and EPA's Office of Research and Development, and we went down to visit Freeport's facilities, and they gave us a tour of some of the work that they're doing. And as a result of that tour that we took in February, this webinar evolved. And with that, I do want to pass it on to Eric.
Okay, and so Eric, we're going to go ahead and call up your presentation content here. In just a moment, Eric, you'll have control over your slides, and you can begin with your portion of the presentation.
Okay, can you hear me?
We can indeed. You sound great.
Excellent. Okay.
Eric, you can begin whenever you're ready.
Okay, as soon as the slides come up here for me, I'll get started. I'll recover, come on. Of course, I always start out with a little technical difficulty, right?
Not a problem. While you're waiting for those slides to load, I'll just remind the audience that they can send in their questions and comments for our presenters at any time using the questions and answer window, which appears in the lower right corner of your screen. You can click on the empty box all the way at the very bottom and type in your message. That's a private window, so you can also send in technical problems or if you're having any issues with the online audio, just go ahead and click on the box, type in your questions or comments, and then hit the enter key. That'll privately submit the messages on in. Eric, have the slides appeared for you?
They have not, but we can begin as they come up. I'm Eric Weiland, and as Roger and everybody indicated, I work for Freeport-McMoRan, and we'll be talking about how we've gone about implementing successful passive bioremediation systems. And so, I now have slides. Okay. So, we'll go to the next slide. We'll see if we can get started here.
Yeah, and Eric, if you have any problems, remember, we can step in at any time to help you advance through those slides.
Yeah, go ahead and go to the next slide. I don't know why it's not responding to me, but it's not. So Freeport-McMoRan is a U.S.-based natural resource company. We have sites around the world, and we're the world's largest publicly traded copper company. There are a few larger companies, but most of those are state-owned. And so one of our big assets, of course, is Grasberg down in Indonesia, and it's the world's, one of the world's largest copper and gold mines. We also have significant mining operations down in South America as well as the U.S. One of our big ones, of course, is Morenci here in Arizona, and the Cerro Verde operation down in South America. We have about 53,000 staff and contractors that work for us, and we're definitely committed to safety. It always comes first, plus the fact that we are on the leading edge of environmental management, and that's both during operations and at the end when we go to closure, as well as looking at these previously mined sites that we've inherited through various acquisitions. And so, let's see, I now have arrows at the bottom here, so let's see if that will advance.
Eric, I have a quick question for you.
Sure.
As though the audio from your phone system is having some intermittent clicking problems. Sometimes the
okay.
fix is to actually have the speaker hang up and call back in. So
okay.
I hate
you want me to?
Yeah, I'd like you to hang up on the phone and call okay. back in, and then we'll double check to see if that helps improve the audio quality for you. While Eric is doing that, we might pause here and just try to take one or two questions for Roger, if you're still with us on the phone. So, Eric, you can hang up. Remember, I'll see you when you dial back in. So we'll check in with Eric here in just a moment. And, Roger, I'm going to unmute you on the phones and ask if you are with me on the phone. Roger, are you there?
I am there. Thank you.
Okay. So, Michelle, do you see a question or two you'd like to take for Roger right now?
Yes. We have had a couple questions come in, Roger. So there was one question about waste being removed from sites and if there's any beneficial reuse happening at some of the sites that you're working on, or if you could talk about that a little bit.
At these particular sites, just because it is a zinc-lead ore body, and how far away your smelters would be to be able to rework these waste rock, we are not doing any type of remining. That doesn't necessarily mean the intent is to put it into a centralized repository, and that at some point in the future when the technology's there, that it won't happen. Does that answer the question, Michelle?
I think so, yeah, definitely. We got another question here about the bio-based systems, and if you have any feeling of how many EPA sites are using them?
I do not, Michelle. Do you have that? You see it more from
I knew you were going to punt it back to me. So we are actually, I'm working on a project with Barb Butler in our Office of Research and Development, and we are collecting information on treatment technologies that we're finding not just at EPA sites, but around the world, and we're combining that information into a handbook. I don't have a number for you, but we will have that information available within the next few months. But I don't have an exact number.
Okay, Michelle, I'm going to jump in here. I think we have Eric back on the line. Eric, are you there?
I am here.
You sound much better.
All right. Technology.
So there we go. So hopefully, Eric, you have full control of your slides right now. I'm going to double check here, and I'll put that pointer up there. Can you wiggle the pointer for me, Eric?
Okay.
There you go.
I grab it. Yep. Okay.
Beautiful.
Got
You're
it.
Back in charge. Go right on ahead.
Okay. Thank you. So as part of Freeport, one of the things that was developed about a decade ago was the Environmental Technology and Life Cycle Group. And what we do is look at transformation. We deliver our value because we don't produce anything other than application of technology, but we deliver value to the company through managing our liabilities, and as you can see on the screen, we do that in developing and deploying our experience and expertise to reduce reclamation and closure costs and reduce the risk in closure. And that's always a big one for us because many times these things last for centuries. We look at reducing our holding costs and extending sustainability of our facilities. We increase the how we develop the projects, and in so doing, basically the velocity of how we implement those deployments of new technology into our various sites, and we do that in according to the market conditions and changing regulations. So by providing the data necessary for various agencies and public acceptance for these innovative programs, we can actually implement them on a fairly timely basis, which is a major thing for us. And so if we look at the environmental technology lifecycle team, let's see, okay, where did that not go? Let's try this. There we go. We are a team of highly skilled professionals, and they range from, like myself, who's a geologist and geochemist, metallurgist, we have civil and environmental engineers on staff, we have biologists on staff, hydrologists, and we also have plant operators. So we primarily work in five major groupings, water treatment being one of our primary ones, and we consider that active water treatment as opposed to the passive type treatment. And there we look at liability management. We also have a source control team, and there we're trying to prevent future liabilities by heading these things off at the source themselves. Migration control, basically that's liability management. Since we've, at that point, we've already got a source that we have an issue with, and therefore we're trying to manage that source so that it does not leave our property or impact other items. And this is where the passive bioremediation systems come into play. We also have residual resource group, and what we do there is we look at monetizing residual assets. So anything that's not our primary production, such as copper, gold, and moly, we can evaluate whether or not it would be feasible to extract that, be it a metal, rare earth, whatever, from our solutions and from our mines, and actually produce that as a profit center. So we actually have a patent for a radium extraction from our solutions, leach solutions, and so that's a big plus to us, and so we keep looking at that. And then once we look at the various technologies that we're trying to implement, the life cycle team looks at how that might be implemented, at what sites we're going to implement it, and how we minimize and manage those future liabilities within this overall package. So our overall intent, of course, is to develop sustainable practices. And so go to the next slide here. Yep. So just to give you an idea of what's coming up, I'm going to talk a little bit about what constitutes a biologically based passive bioremediation system, what factors affect the success of that implementation, some of the design criteria that we've identified as important. We'll take a short break for questions, and then we'll get into the test cases. And in this case, we're going to have three test cases I'm going to talk about. One's the laboratory test case, treatability testing for Montana. We'll then also talk about an on-site pilot scale treatability test that we did in Tyrone, where we looked at how far we could push this technology as far as the chemistry of the water. And then we'll look at the successful implementation at Iron King that's been now in operation for over 8 years. And then finally, we'll go into our questions and discussions at the end. And we'll go to the next slide. So what is a biologically based passive bioremediation system? Well, it's obviously it's biologically based. It looks at passively treating the waters. And there's various strategies available to us to do this. And one of the big ones, of course, is sulfate-reducing bioreactors. And then also we look at the enhancement of natural processes. And those processes could be physical, chemical, or biological. And that comes into play both with the sulfate-reducing bioreactors and the constructed wetlands. I'm not going to go into rock reactors today because that's more on the active side, where you have a vessel that you add the constituents to on a regular basis. And I'm not going to talk about reactive barriers, which are more related to petroleum-type impacts, where they use zero-valent iron, et cetera, to surround any of those particular impacts. Usually our sites are so large that those are not very well and cannot be applied very nicely. And then just to give you a quick overview, I'm not going to go into all of these, but we will use some acronyms used throughout the presentations today. So for those that download the presentations, these are our acronyms we'll be using. And for the most part, I'll say the actual word rather than acronym when I'm talking to them within the slides themselves. And so let's see, next slide. Okay, so before I completely get off of our active versus passive, I thought I'd throw this slide in, since I know there's a lot of different experiences and levels of knowledge out there on this particular webinar, just to give you background. So an active SRBR would be one where you actually put the materials into a tank, you stir it, and then you replace it as needed. These can be, you know, also have a membrane reactor or a submerged packed bed reactor, as opposed to a passive sulfate-reducing biochemical reactor, which is basically a hole in the ground that you put your materials into, your substrate, and then you allow the water to go through it, and you only come back and maintain it if and when you have to. The big difference, of course, is how these actually work from a microbial standpoint. The active sulfate-reducing bioreactors tend to be the growth is suspended or attached to the material, and it, the suspended is the primary one, whereas within the passive, it's really attached to the media itself, the substrate. As far as the electron donor that's necessary, within the active, you can have a liquid or a gas phase. In the passive, it's more the solid phase or sometimes a slowly degradable liquid. And in almost all cases that we've been aware of or worked with, the sulfate reduction rate and the metal removal rate in the active treatment is much higher than in any passive treatments that we've been able to establish. Okay, so since we're going to be talking about biologically based passive bioremediation systems, I thought I'd go into just the components that we deal with here primarily, and they include pretreatment potentially, which is an alkalinity reactor, and so this is a source of trying to raise the pH to primarily precipitate aluminum and iron, and therefore decrease the acidity loading going into the bioreactor itself. This is usually, in our cases, mostly limestone that we use for that. And then, but we can occasionally use other materials that have alkalinity associated with them. Then you get into the sulfate-reducing biochemical reactor itself, and this is composed of an electron source, which is our organic substrate. Sulfate is our electron acceptor, and what happens is sulfate gets reduced to sulfide ions, hydrogen sulfide, and that hydrogen sulfide then targets metal precipitation as metal sulfides. And so most of the target metals for this are plus two cations, just from the standpoint of the stoichiometric aspects of the chemical reactions. We also have an alkalinity source within the biochemical reactor itself. In most, or so far in all of our cases, we've actually used limestone within the biochemical reactor itself. And sulfate reduction also adds to the alkalinity. What we're trying to achieve here is circumneutral pH, because we find that that is the optimum condition for the sulfate-reducing bacteria itself. And then the, let's see, did that come up? Hello, try again. Why is it not advancing?
Eric, we're currently looking at slide 11. It might just be a slight lag on your end.
Okay. So let me go back one. There we go. Sorry about that. It was that. I will pause in between to make sure I don't accidentally hit it too many times. So then the third part of our passive bioremediation system is a constructive wetland or an aqueous polythene cell. And here what we're looking for is to reduce those metals that didn't get precipitated out within the bioreactor, and also treat the biological oxygen demand that is produced from the SRB, and also manganese, which is a primary metal that is not treated well within the sulfate-reducing bioreactor itself. And so we look at our various reactor ways we do that, and sequestration, of course, is a primary one within the wetland. We also get precipitation, but in this case, it's the oxides, oxyhydroxide, and carbonates. We get sorption on our mineral and biological, mostly the roots, systems. We can get sedimentation if it's a suspended solid. We get filtration of the suspended solids. We also can increase alkalinity in the constructed wetland and increase dissolved oxygen, and then therefore also reduce our BOD. So those are our primary components that we have on these systems. Now, perfect. So what's the design criteria that we look at? For the most part, we look at sites that have low flow rates. We're finding that from 1 to 50 GPM tends to be the most favorable. And the reason for that is that we need hydraulic retention times that allow for the reactions to occur. And then we also need to look at what our treatment criteria is. And so because the treatment criteria will depend on, or will indicate what size of reactor we need and our system we need, and then the longevity also we tend to take a look at. Primary concerns, of course, are mass loading going into our system. So that could be sulfate, which of course is critical to the success of any sulfate reducing bioreactor application. We also have metals that we want to look at, and they can range from the acidic metals like aluminum and iron, the metal sulfides we're trying to precipitate, and our oxidized metalloids such as manganese for the wetlands. We also have to evaluate potential toxins. We have found that DO, especially if we have low metal concentrations, can become a constraint. H2S, if it gets too high, can also become a problem. And we've also determined that antibacterial materials within some of the substrates have reduced the effectiveness of this. And so I'll talk to that a little bit again later when we talk about our case studies. And so what we do is we look from the standpoint of design and operational considerations. We, as I say, water quality objectives are key, and that's because not all water needs to be treated to the level of releasing it to a stream, say. And then we also have to look at site conditions and topography. These are usually best if there's a slight slope to the system, so we can use the gradients to drive the system. We also need to ensure that we have sufficient area and things can be placed logistically so that they'll all work together. If there's infrastructure available, i.e. can we get machinery in there, etc., those are things we have to look at from a design and operational perspective. One thing just to note is higher flow rates provide less contact time for the same size reactors. This can lead to incomplete reactions, and therefore you might not achieve the water quality you're expecting. Also, washout, both the bacteria and the Fidon sulfide precipitates. We find that those are two key things that we have to watch out for. As I say, there are some potential toxins that we also take a look at. For those of you who are not familiar with sulfate-reducing bioreactors, I'm putting a diagram on the screen here. This is just a general form that they take, but as I say, you've got a hole in the ground and you've got your organic matter and limestone mix, and then we cover that just to keep water, surface water runoff from getting in there, and also to maintain the reducing conditions. So we look at reducing the sulfate by generating hydrogen sulfide, and then hopefully that will reduce the metal contents by precipitating out the metal sulfides, and we add the alkalinity and increasing the pH to circumneutral. Okay. Anytime now? There we go. I also wanted to go in for those of you who have a little bit more experience with sulfate-reducing bioreactors. The criteria that we use, the basic aspect of that, we look at sulfate loading rate because it's important to know how much sulfate is coming in, and then we design our systems and we evaluate our systems based on the sulfate removal rates to determine whether or not we can effectively remove sulfate down to the levels that we need to. And so here you can see that the loading rate, of course, is, if I get back to my arrow, is a function of the flow rate going into the bioreactor and then the sulfate load concentration coming into it. And then the removal is done through this sulfate reduction there we go, to sulfide, and that basically you have an electron acceptor, which is your sulfate, and an electron donor, which is your organic material, and what happens there is then you produce your reactive sulfide product. And this is all done, what we're trying to get to is a number for the sulfate removal rate, so we can use that in our calculations for what area and mass is needed of materials for the SRBR. And one thing that we have noticed that is not common in the literature is that we are moving towards using mass of the bioreactor substrate rather than the volume of the substrate. We're finding that there's less variance within that data, and we can better understand exactly what's going into the bioreactor at that point. Okay, so, and then the second part of the equation for the design criteria is the metal loading and removal rates. And once again, on the metal loading rate is important. So we look at the flow rates and the sum of all the metals that we're trying to evaluate that we consider critical coming in. And then we look at the actual precipitation via the sulfide reaction and the metal removal rate that we need to calculate, once again, based on the mass of the bioreactor substrate itself. And so the size of the bioreactor, of course, is also looked at using this particular set of formulas. And so we then have both a sulfate removing rate and a removal rate and a metal removal rate on the whole thing. And so that's what's used to calculate the actual mass of substrate that we need within a reactor, and therefore we can decide on the size of the bioreactor that we need. And then when we look towards the constructed wetlands, we try and emphasize the wetland qualities for improved treatments. So things that the wetlands do naturally, like oxidize and filtration and the roots and the stems and the leaves, the uptake of metals within those wetlands, those are all the things that we're trying to emphasize when we construct one of these things. We use this in conjunction with other treatment technologies for the most part. We have not implemented any wetlands on their own. However, there are some companies that have done that in the past. The two primary ones that we look at are the free water surface wetland and a vertical flow wetland. What we do, once again, is target primarily biochemical oxygen demand and manganese with our wetlands. However, we do find that we also gain other things like removal of suspended solids, etc. Let's see. So from the basic design criteria, as soon as it comes up here, come on, yes, maybe. There we go. Once again, we look at loading rates. So loading rates here would be BOD and manganese plus any other constituents that haven't been removed from either pretreatment or the bioreactor. We look at flow rates because, once again, here the hydrology and hydraulics are critical, and so it will also depend on which of the two systems you're using. And again, low to moderate flow rates are most favorable. Metal removal, as I indicated, sedimentation, sorption, precipitation, filtration, and of course, sequestration by plants are important. Of course, we have to have equations for our wetland as far as design criteria. And here what we do is look at two different things as far as sizing. The first one that we look at is the sizing based on BOD. And again, we have a loading rate. So we have a daily mass loading of BOD right here, if I can get my, there we go. And then the size of the wetland, we can look at it from a daily loading rate perspective. And you can see here the equation for that. One of the things that we have found is the daily loading rate, for the most part, is between 60 to 100 kilograms per hectare per day. Just as a note, the EPA in the late 90s indicated 54 pounds of BOD per acre per day. So we've actually extended that somewhat from our experiments. And I'll go to the next one. So there's another way of looking at this, and that is the wetland design based on BOD, but using a first order reaction rate kinetics. And for those of you who want to, this is another way that we look at it. We usually calculate both methods to determine how we want to proceed. And let me get there. Oops. So I'm not going to go into details here, but if any of you want additional information at later date, please don't hesitate to let us know about that, and we can provide more information on the sizing based on a first-order kinetics. The second reason, second way we look at sizing is based on manganese. And once again, we do it similar to the way we looked at BOD. One thing to note is that BOD has to be removed first before we can actually start oxidation of manganese, otherwise there's not enough oxygen in the system. And again, we look at a mass loading rate, and then we use that mass loading rate to determine our size of a wetland, and looking at a general range of numbers that we have found to be significant in our particular implementations. Okay. And naturally, there's also the first order removal rate method, also based on manganese. And as you can see, it's very similar to the form that was used for BOD. And so we go through and we calculate these. And based on that design criteria, then we look at how we would, whether or not we can reasonably implement this technology at a particular site. And so, okay, I'm gonna try this one more time. Hopefully I won't jump too many. There we go. So just to finish up this background section of the thing before we get into the case studies, just wanted to once again remind everybody of the design criteria that we look at for when we go in to evaluate one, you know, would this technology even be worth evaluating on a particular site? Or once we've started to look at it, what kinds of things we need to identify and questions we need to ask in order to determine whether or not this technology can be implemented in a reasonable way so that it meets all of the criteria that's necessary, such as what the discharge requirements are, and also, of course, the financial and infrastructure constraints, as well as the technical aspects of it, which are the chemistry, the site attributes, and the kinds of substrates we might use and plant availability. Whenever we get a chance, we always try and use plants that are available locally for both the bioreactor and wetlands. And our initial design criteria, as mentioned earlier, are our sulfate loading and removal rates, our metal loading and removal rates, and then the oxygen loading rates. And that's usually only necessary in really low metal loadings where oxygen may poison the system and not allow the sulfate-reducing bacteria to grow properly. And with that, we'll take our first quick break here, and I can answer some questions while we're doing that and give everybody a chance to get up, stretch, or whatever. And then we'll get into the test cases.
Okay, Eric, this is Michelle Mahoney. We are getting a lot of questions coming in, and I'm just wondering, I want to check in with you if, just in the interest of time, if you would prefer to continue with your presentation so that you can get through the material before we start asking questions. I do feel that a number of the questions that are coming in may be answered once you start presenting the case studies and the, you know, real-life applicability of what you're discussing.
But okay.
I just want to make sure that's enough time to get through your material.
Yeah, it's up to you, Michelle, whether or not, because I can certainly continue on and see if we can answer most of those questions. And then if we have, we'll just have more time at the end, too, to answer questions
right, as
we go forward. Right. So that would be fine with me.
Okay, great. I think that would be the best, just to make sure that you can get through your material, and I'll continue to monitor the questions. Thank you.
Uh-huh, thank you. Okay, so selected case studies. I'm going to go through three case studies. One will be a laboratory bench scale. The second one will be an on-site pilot scale test that we ran. And the third will be actually Iron King, which has been operating for approximately 8+ years. So the laboratory bench scale is the one we're doing with Roger, and that's up in Montana. It's the Little Belt Mountains. It's a historical mine impacted water, as Roger was mentioning, and our primary goal here is seepage water management. And so have a picture of our setup. So this is in our environmental technology lab we have here in Tucson. And we have a greenhouse where we've set this particular one up. We have multiple columns that we operate with. Certain ones are getting pretreatment, and that limestone reactor is 42 inches tall and 8 inches in diameter. And you can't actually see it because it's hiding behind the columns over here. But then we the actual bioreactors themselves, the sulfate-reducing bioreactors, we have 12 columns. They're all 46 inches tall, but some of them are smaller than others. So if we have limestone pretreatment, the columns are smaller. Yeah, without limestone pretreatment, of course, we have the requirement for larger substrates, or higher amounts of substrates, and so those are both 4-inch and 8-inch diameter to see how they operate. As you can see, we have pumps that control the flow rates. On the back side over here, which is a little tougher to see, are the meters, so we actually have flow-through cells where we monitor pH and electroconductivity on a regular basis and temperature. Our wetlands are over here, and we have four tanks, and each of those are 24 inches by 24 inches, and the substrate's 16 inches deep, and they collect the water from a pair of bioreactors, and then that water effluent from the bioreactor is metered into the wetlands, and then we collect the outflow from the wetlands, and that's our final treated water, which we then compare to what our water quality objectives are at the whole for the this particular project. And so on this, what we did was we initially calculated our potential flow rates through those columns by each of the three methods I discussed earlier. So we have an optimal flow rate based on metal reduction, an optimal flow rate based on sulfate reduction, and an optimal flow rate based on oxygen loading. And as you can see here, all three of those are different. And so our initial target for these was the 0.9 liters per day. And that is where we wanted to start it. And then if we found that we were successful at that, we would move to higher and higher flow rates on a regular basis. And so, but as you can see here, in this particular case, the oxygen loading rate is much, much higher than either the metal or the sulfate, which is why we have found that the oxygen loading rate doesn't tend to be a problem except in really low metal contents. So now we'll take a look at some of the data. And on this, if I get a hold of the arrow here, I have two sets of graphs, one without limestone pretreatment and one with limestone pretreatment. This upper line is the feed going into the limestone or into the SRBR. In this case, it'd be without pretreatment, and in this case, it's with pretreatment. And then the dashed line here is the flow rate for that particular set of reactors. And then you can see here we have four different reactors all within that same setup. And so as we move forward, so days are along the bottom axis, and this happens to be ORP. ORP, since we're looking for reducing conditions, has to be minus. And as you can see, as we started to reach our negative ORPs, we increased our flow rate and maintained our reducing conditions, which is what we wanted to do. And you can see that on both cases. This one, it went up a little bit to begin with and then came back down. But they're both operating within that reduced conditions for our sulfate-reducing bacteria. Now, if we look at the sulfate removal rates for these same reactors, you can see on this bottom left where we have no pretreatment that we're having our sulfate removal rate is in the order of 1 millimoles per kilogram per day. And with limestone pretreatment, we're getting somewhere in the neighborhood of 0.5, one millimole per kilogram per day there as well. And so all of the reactors at this point are operating as planned, and we have increased the flow rate now. So that we can test this, because this was our optimum flow rate that we had determined earlier. And so now we're increasing it to see how far we can push these systems. And so next I'd like to take, so that's the sulfate data, the ORP and the sulfate data. And next I want to take a look at the metal data. So on the metal data, as you can see, these are the same bioreactors. And this is copper. And copper coming into the bioreactors up at about 1,000 micrograms per liter. Coming out of the bioreactor, it was about 100 to begin with. And now that the sulfate-reducing bioreactor is operating, you can see it's coming down significantly as this is a log, so we're more than one order of magnitude less. This solid line is our target for copper, and you can see that shortly after we started the optimum flow rate, we actually had copper below our benchmark concentration coming out of the bioreactor, and that's both with limestone pretreatment and without limestone pretreatment. And the orange line here happens to be the copper concentration coming out of the limestone pretreatment system. And so if we look at metal removal rate for these, you can see that we have our metal removal rate during the time period here of just under 0.3. millimoles per kilogram per day, and approximately 0.4 when we have limestone pretreatment. So both are operating properly, and once again, it appears that we can actually increase our flow rates through these systems higher than what we originally projected. So we go to next. Slide here. So what we found, of course, as Roger said, collaboration is a key piece to this, especially in planning for success, not only at the lab scale, but when we go to actual implementation. And one of the big things we found on this particular set of tests in the laboratory, we were flushing quite a bit of organics during our initial flow rate, and that led to some analytical challenges, but we've recovered from that and so have been able to proceed easily. The initial inoculation phase of the bioreactor may not have been required. A lot of times we do this just trying to build up the colonies of bacteria. But we are now beginning to recommend that we begin with low flow for these types of laboratory tests rather than just letting it sit idle for a period of time, because if there's not enough sulfate in the water, then you lose part of your population just from that. And as you can see, we're achieving reasonable sulfate reducing conditions and also metal reducing or removal conditions for both of these. And so then I'm going to go, since we're, okay, come on, there we go. Okay, so now I'll move to the treatability test that we did on site over at Tyrone in New Mexico. It's an operational mine. We have a reclaimed leaching facility that has seepages that we currently control by sending it back through the process and using it as process water. What we were looking at is from a pre-closure mine impacted water treatability perspective, can we treat this water passively if we want to close the system and not have to use it within the operations. As you can see here, very high TDS waters with lots of metals and sulfate. It was a 400-day pilot test, so just over a year that we did this. And I'll show you the setup here as soon as it comes up. Well, maybe. I pressed it. Let me try it one more time. Ah, there we go. So we had this in a Connex, and our bioreactors were paired 90-gallon reactors, and they were all operated in a downflow configuration. And we evaluated two pretreatment strategies, and then we also evaluated two different bioreactor substrate compositions in this test. And we evaluated the wetlands from the standpoint of looking at reducing manganese, which is fairly high, and VOD following the primary treatment of SRBRs. We used three native species, and since I'm not a biologist, I'm not going to even attempt to indicate what those were, but they're there. As I say, we try and use native species whenever possible on our testing. And then let's take a look quickly at the data. So in this slide, there's several things going on. We have six bioreactors, each of them paired. But we changed the flow rate. So flow rate is our vertical axis, and time in days is our horizontal axis. And as you can see, if you take this pair of bioreactors, it was going along at 3 liters per day, then we dropped it down to 1, and then as it recovered, we went back up to 2, and then back up to 3 before the end. And several of these we changed during the entire period of time, as you can see. What we found, however, was there was a area that, as far as the flow rate was concerned, that became the optimum flow rate for the various bioreactors. And that's shown by this gray box. So for bioreactors 1 and 2, it was the 2 liters per day. For 5 and 3, it was 6 liters per day. And for 4 and 6, it was at the 9 liters per day. So that all figured into how we then went through and calculated out our parameters that we would use to actually design a system. And I know this next slide is a little busy, but it's important. I thought to include all of this just from the standpoint for those of you who have downloaded the slides. And here what we have is the flow rate for each of the SRBRs. As you can see, 1 and 2 were paired, and those did not have any pretreatment. 3 and 4 had the active calcium hydroxide pretreatment, and 5 and 6 had limestone pretreatment prior to the sulfate-reducing bioreactor. This is the flow rates that I indicate that became the optimal flow rate. This is the HRT that we calculated for those flow rates. And this is the percent removal of the metals and the sulfate for those particular flow rates and columns. You can see there's quite a range here. And one of the big things we found is that we were never able to get sulfate below 4,500 milligrams per liter, and that's primarily because we started out at 16,000. Even though we got fairly decent reductions percentage-wise within sulfate, we did, however, were able to remove 100% of several of our metals that we were targeting. And, of course, the bioreactor is not designed to take out manganese, and you can see that most cases that was the case. And So then let's take a look at the next slide.
Eric, very quickly, we've got approximately 10 minutes left for this scheduled webinar.
Okay.
I know that we did run into some technical difficulties, just had to get you disconnected and reconnected. So I wanted to let the audience know that we will stay just a few minutes past our scheduled end time to try to take some questions. So I don't want to rush you through the content, but I'm hoping that we can get through as much as we can, Eric, in the next few moments, and then stay a few minutes past 3:30 to take questions from the audience, okay?
All right. Okay.
Thank you
for that note. Similar from the standpoint of when we look at metal removal rates for these sulfate-reducing bioreactors, one thing you can see here is that the sulfate removal rate was higher than the metal removal rate, and that's partially because a lot of the metals were removed completely before removing all of the sulfate. I won't go into any of the big details here, but these are the key criteria that we will then use to actually design or implement a bioreactor, if we decide to do that, out at Tyrone. And of course, what we'll do is look at all of these data and determine which ones we feel are most acceptable for a risk-based analysis or a risk-based implementation. I do want to just quickly show the manganese on the constructed wetland. And as you can see here, this is the manganese going in. This is the manganese coming out of the bioreactor. This is the manganese concentrations coming out of the oxidizing pond that we had. And then these are the concentrations of manganese coming out of the wetlands itself. So in most cases, or in all these cases, we were able to treat manganese to the level that we desired by the time we finished with the constructed wetlands. And we'll go to the next slide. And I won't go into any detail on this one either, but just note that before, when we were talking about the various efficiencies and the area-adjusted removal rates and the first-order removal rates, these are the ones that we came up with from this particular test, treatability test, which are all within the range, but slightly higher than those in the published literature for the most part. And we'll go to the next slide so we can get to the... So this is just our general observations. I think the big key here is the fact that we found that we actually could treat this high TDS mine impacted water, but there would not be possible to use this or just release this into the environment. But it is quite usable within our operations. And so from that perspective, it would be necessary to have a bigger wetland to assist with a lot of this. The metal removal rates that we calculated for copper and zinc, which are two of the primary ones that a lot of people look at, can be seen here. And these are all at or above the metal removal rates that have been published for most bioreactors that are out there and academic research that's gone into it. We definitely needed a wetland following the passive bioremediation system on this one. And let's go to Iron King quickly, and because this is our real success story here. And so Iron King Historical Mine is a voluntary remediation project, a fairly large glory hole. And As you can see, we based the design on 10 gallons per minute in 2009. Right now, we're down to about 2 gallons per minute on the actual implementation. And so what I'm going to do is quickly go through some slides that show before and after. So this is the Abbott with the glory hole, which was up above here before we started our reclamation and putting in the bioreactor. This is, oops, if I can get there. Yeah, this is the current, actually it was in 2012 after our reclamation and bioreactor was put in. This is the site, and as we started construction, this is the site for the bioreactor and wetland, or what we're calling an APC, the aerobic polishing cell, and that was in 2012. This shows some of the materials that we used as substrate. We had wood chips and sawdust brought on site. As you can see, we also added alfalfa hay to help ignite the whole process, limestone to increase the alkalinity, and we used manure, of course, for our inoculation of the system. And if that comes up, oops. Here you see the settling pond during construction, and the settling pond as it's seen in 2012. And then this is the construction of the aerobic polishing shells, where we have the different levels going down, and this is the way it was in 2012 once the bioreactor got started and we started releasing water to that system. So we targeted zinc and cadmium for this particular one. You can see there the design flow rate and the current operating conditions, and all of our effluent from the bioreactor is well within the criteria that we were looking for right here. And we have zero dark discharge from the APC, so this is considered a zero discharge facility at this point. And then I'll just quickly show a couple of so this is cadmium from the beginning, and oops. So this is going, this is the influent coming in, and this is the bioreactor going out. And the APC, of course, it has no outflow whatsoever. And then looking at zinc, similar conditions, inflow and outflow from the bioreactor. And once again, we're meeting the conditions that we set for ourselves within the voluntary system of remediation. And so then, anytime, come on up. One more time. There you go. Okay. So we've met our voluntary remediation project objectives and project goals. As you can see here, these are the types of sulfate reduction rates we get, and removal rates and metal removal rates from this system. The settling pond does remove suspended particulates, and so we consider that an important piece of that. And I think the key here is that we've treated 7.6 million gallons of seepage that has not gotten into the environment. So This just is a quick observations. The fact that we feel collaboration and planning is key. We can treat a wide range of MIW flows and chemistry. Lab and pilot scale testings are important, especially when you're using new substrates. Optimum sulfate removal rate and metal removal rates may be higher than the published rates, and that's the value of our pilot scale testing and bench scale testing. Water quality objectives definitely drive whether or not the system will be a success and also the size of the treatment system. And these things are very effective. So I will put this last slide up, maybe. Come on. And then we can go to questions. Oops, last slide. It jumped. Must have hit it twice. There we go. So I'm put this up. These are just a reminder of what we consider the key design criteria. We have found that we can successfully implement these systems. It takes a little bit of effort, and not every site is the same. So we do a lot of bench scale and pilot scale testings up front to ensure that when we go to final design, we have one that will not only work on day one, but work for an extended period of time. And with that, Michelle, I'll open up to questions.
Okay, great. Thank you, Eric. Yeah, this presentation was very engaging. We received many, many, many questions, and I've been reading through them and have found a couple common themes, people asking similar types of questions. So I think maybe I'll start with those. So there was some interest in knowing what types of organics that you're using in your wetland studies. I didn't hear you speak of any specific, so I was wondering if you could elaborate on that.
Well, the wetlands, especially, we tend to try and get local materials. Actually, Lenny, my biologist, just walked in the door, so maybe what I'll do is I'll let him answer that specifically, since he can actually talk to that directly.
In terms of organics, we've implemented just regular compost material mixed with sand, general construction sand. Occasionally we'll implement some limestone in there for additional buffering capacity of effluent. We've also utilized vertical flow wetlands that consist of only pea gravel and construction sand with success. So it really does vary on the water quality objectives and our treatment goals.
Okay, and a follow-on to that, do these materials have a lifespan, and if so, is there any disposal challenges?
For the bioreactors, they certainly do have a lifespan. In the literature and amongst practitioners, they usually shoot for 10 to 20 year lifespan for the organic substrate, and then at which point it needs to be excavated and then disposed of properly and then refilled again and start it all over. So
one of the things that we're finding is that a lot of times when we design these, you design at the higher flow rates, which are at the current thing, but if we practice source control and we minimize the amount of water going into these things, the flow rates decrease with time, and therefore the longevity of the systems lasts quite a bit longer than we initially intended. I don't know if that helps, but.
Yeah, it does. And actually, your statement leads into another question that I noticed a trend in people asking about flow, and if you could talk a little bit about how flow is controlled during your field implementation, if there was any examples of added flow management to the reactor with seasonal variations, and then also, what if there's no flow? Is that detrimental to treatment?
The only time no flow would be detrimental would be if we completely dry out the bioreactor, because then it would end up having to restart itself once flow reestablished. I'm moving back in my slides. hopefully. And to show, once again, the Iron King at it, and I can explain that a little bit better once I have that up. There we go. So as indicated, so this was the original condition of that particular site. All the glory hole above it, we capped that. So we closed that completely, shed the all water from that site around this area. And so the seepage that does come down here, as we indicated, started out, we thought it was going to be about 10 gallons per minute, but then it's down to about, well, less than 2 gallons per minute at this point. And so what we do is we basically collect it in this adit and then pipe it to this connex, where it then gets piped down to our bioreactor itself. And so that's how we control the direction of the water. Now, in this particular case, we do, just in case we had excess water flow, we do have valves and things that we can direct the water around the bioreactor and into the APC directly, just in case. But we've never had to use that other than occasionally with the maintenance aspect. So. Does that help?
Yes. Yes, that was very good. Okay. Thank you. We did just get a request. Lenny, we're glad that you joined us, but maybe when you jump in to speak, you could identify yourself so people can notice the difference between you or Eric responding. So I just wanted to point that out. So there was a couple questions about clogging, and if you have any issues with clogging, particularly in the alkalinity reactor. And if so, how do you manage that when it becomes an issue?
Yes, especially with some of our laboratory and pilot studies, we've had where aluminum especially becomes highly hydrated, and therefore you can get clogging. What we do is we either flush it occasionally, and even in the literature they talk about having basically flushing systems where you push the water back through the opposite direction to flush things out, a back flush type approach. In many cases, what we do is actually just take that limestone out and remove it and replace it. What we're trying to do is, in a lot of our experiments, is determine what the optimum size is so that we get the type of alkalinity we want, but reduce the amount of clogging that we get from that, you know, so we keep the pore spaces fairly large. And but it is an issue, and it's primarily an issue within the limestone reactor. Within the SRBR, we don't tend to have as much of a problem there because it's more distributed across a larger area.
Okay, great. I think I have two more questions I'd like to ask you. One is about cost, and if there was any information you could share, just the cost per pound for treating contaminant mass or some sort of data like that, if you had anything handy to share.
Don't have it handy. I can tell you this, that it ranges considerably depending upon the type of water we're trying to treat. Some of the waters we try and treat is fairly inexpensive. I don't remember offhand what Iron King cost us, but I think it was around $1.5 million. And as I indicated, we, you know, processed, I don't remember the number now, a sizable amount of water at this point. So 7.6 million, so that's approximately where we're at with that cost of that particular site. The Montana sites that we're working with Roger on are likely to be less rather than more than that, whereas Tyrone, because of the increased metal loading and sulfate loading. If we decide to do that, of course, that's going to be a much higher cost.
Okay, thank you. And one other question that's come up another time, a number of times, is about temperature. And does the bioremediation work during cold weather? How does the temperature influence removal efficiency? What's your experience with different locations?
So far, all the reactors we've worked with out in the field have worked throughout multiple seasons, et cetera. There may be a slight decrease during the wintertime, but because the bioreactors themselves create heat, if we insulate them and design the covers properly, they basically generate enough heat to keep themselves going in the wintertime. So then it's just the temperature of the water coming out of the system. So if it's coming out of an adit, that adit water is usually pretty constant temperature throughout the year, whereas if it's like a development rock dump or something like that, the temperature may change more dramatically in the wintertime. And so you might have a decrease there, but most of the bioreactors we've worked with, we haven't seen an issue with that. And Garfield, which I didn't have time to talk about here, up in Colorado, in the wintertime, of course, it's got snow on top of it, and it's working just fine.
Great. Well, Eric, I want to thank you so much for your time and your presentation and all the details that you shared with us. I mean, this is really wonderful and full of lots of information, and you really engaged the audience, and I just want to thank you again for taking the time to present with us. And also, Roger, thank you very much for being with us and introducing us to Eric in this site, and we really appreciate your time.
We really appreciate the opportunity to present this material and provide this our findings that, you know, this is really a technology worth investigating. So thank you.
Definitely. Thank you so much. Now I'm going to turn it back to Jean Ballant, who's going to make our closing remarks for our session today.
All right. Thank you so very much, Michelle. I appreciate everybody's time for joining us for today's broadcast. Just a few quick reminders, and then we'll let everyone go on with their day. We apologize for going over, but thank you to those of you who stayed on for a few extra moments for today's webinar. As Michelle noted, we currently have a number of mining-related webinars available to replay on demand. Today's session was recorded and will be added into that list as well. But if you'd like to, you can visit the CLUIN mining page at cluin.org/mining, and then click the little triangle next to the mining webinar series archive. That list will expand, and you can browse through a number of webinars that have been archived on similar topics. If you are looking for copies of the presentation materials or some of the resources and websites that were discussed, they are available under the Related URLs window. You can scroll through that on the middle right, click on any one of the links of interest, and then press the Browse To button to open it up. For those of you who might be lucky enough to be replaying the recorded version of our webinar today, you can still follow those links to Related URLs, click on them to select one, and then press the Browse To button to open it up. Contact information for our presenters and organizers can also be found on the seminar homepage on the Presenters tab. I will ask if you could take just a moment to fill out our online feedback form to let us know what you thought of today's broadcast. A number of you have asked for a confirmation or some sort of credit for attending the webinar today. We do not issue CEUs or PDHs. However, we do offer participation certificates for those of you who joined us for the full live event or replayed the entire archived version. So if you follow the link to the seminar feedback form, there is a box that when you fill that form out at the very bottom will ask you to certify you were there for the entire session. As long as you complete the form correctly and you check that box, once you submit your feedback for today's session, you will immediately have access to a participation certificate that you can either save, print out, and we'll also email a copy of that certificate to you. If you attended as part of a group under someone else's registration, you can still click the link to the feedback form, fill out your own feedback form, get your own certificate, even though you participated through someone else's registration. So again, for those of you in a group setting, you'll want to individually fill out that feedback form to get your own certificate for attending today's session. And so, as I said earlier, today's session was recorded, and you will also receive an email as soon as the archive is available for on-demand playback. We value everyone's time. There were approximately 350 attendees here for today's live broadcast from all over the world. And I also want to thank all of the presenters and organizers who helped put together today's session. This was the first webinar in the series, as Michelle was mentioning, so we're going to carry on with this. Again, I know it's not the very first one. The webinar series is ongoing. I apologize. So you will continue to see additional webinars on this topic on Kluin. So again, I hope that you'll have us in your mind when you're looking for additional online training opportunities, and we'll have you join us for our next one. So with that, this will be the formal conclusion for today's live broadcast.